Catholic theology departments have been suspect for decades. How did they become so bad, and what is the proper way to teach theology? That's going to be our topic today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, just want to encourage people to like and subscribe to the channel, wherever you might watch it, wherever you might listen to it. We really do appreciate that. Also, you can follow Crisis Magazine at Crisis Mag on all the major social media outlets. Today, our guest is Dr. Michael Cirilla. He is the director of graduate theology and professor of systematic and dogmatic theology in the BA and MA theology programs at Franciscan University. Welcome to the program, Mike.
Thanks, Eric. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Yeah, so this is a topic I think most Catholics, we know that Catholic theology, as it comes to us through most theology departments, both at the college level, university level, and high schools, is generally pretty dismal and can't really be trusted. And so that's what my opinion is. I think that seems to be what a lot of people think. What will be your general sense of like theology departments, at least in America? We'll stick to America.
Well, first of all, that's your opinion, but I think it's also demonstrated factually by the fact that Newman guide schools are interesting to people. Why? Because we're unlike other Catholic universities and colleges. How? Because we're Orthodox, basically faithful to the Church's and Christ's teaching. It's tricky. If you're asking about the current state, I think we're in a situation that we've been in for about 50 plus years, but the ground is shifting a little bit. So we have a burgeoning number of Catholic institutions either recovering their Catholic identity or being founded with a strong Catholic identity. That is fidelity to Christ, fidelity to the Church's magisterium, Orthodox, and good, you know, just solid. Back in the day, there was just Franciscan University, Christendom, and Thomas Aquinas College. Now the Newman list is maybe 20 or so schools. So that's growing, and that's good. We also have a phenomenon that Jerry Bradley, professor of law at University of Notre Dame, foretold, prophesied even, years ago in an article he wrote, where he said, look, the Catholic universities that are losing their Catholic identity since the 60s, and there's a reason why, if you want to talk about it, we can talk about how this happened. But in any event, the Catholic universities who are losing their Catholic identity have no value added, so to speak, compared to the local state university. Why pay more and go to a Catholic institution if what you can get the same, essentially the same education at a secular state institution down the road? And his prediction was that a lot of those universities would fold and close, and a lot of them have.
Right. Now, how did it happen? I think the question I have is more like a chicken and the egg question. So we know things degraded in the church just universally in the 1960s and beyond and to our day. The question is, did Catholic theology, how it was taught, did it degrade first and that kind of led to a lot of the problems? Or was the degradation of Catholic theology departments, is that just another result of everything kind of going badly in the 1960s and beyond?
Well, you're right. There's cross-pollinization going into the mix. But to back up a bit, I think here's what happens, what's been happening the last 100 or so years, 120 years. We have the modernist heresy in the early 20th century, where you have a bunch of Catholic theologians claiming and saying that they adhere to church teaching, and they did to the words, but they attach different meanings to that teaching. Pius X condemned it, excommunicated a number of modernist heretics, and they went underground. So there was a few years of a great revival of Catholic Orthodoxy, including Neo-Thomism, people like Gergou Lagrange and others, Father Gergou Lagrange and others. But then... right around the 50s and 60s, especially at the Second Vatican Council, in the preparatory phase, John the 23rd, so to speak, rehabilitated a number of these formerly silenced theologians. And so we have a reemergence of what you can call neo-modernism in the 60s. Really, frankly, Eric, I'd say one of the lack of discipline on the part of the governance structure of the church, that they actually either facilitated this reemergence of this problem, or turned a blind eye, or both, to it. So, of course, the Second Vatican Council, you had factions warring, these very liberal progressive factions, and then a just solidly Catholic faction. And after the council, you had things like in the late 1960s, what's called the infamous Land O'Lakes Statement, put out by a number of Catholic administrators, including presidents of Catholic universities in the United States of America, especially most notably Theodore Herzberg, Father Theodore Herzberg, the president of University of Notre Dame at the time. And basically, it was a declaration of independence from the magisterium. You know, everybody had to take this oath against modernism that Pius X required of all theologians. And they balked at that. And Paul VI himself, in the early 70s, a little after the Land O'Lakes Declaration, decided to get rid of the oath against modernism. So, Eric, yeah, theologians that were unrestrained, who many of them were doing some bad things, some dissent. Hans Küng had a book called Infallible, and the question mark, and the answer about papacy, and his answer is no. That's the thesis, is that there's no papal infallibility ever. Okay, and guys like that, and you know, Father Charles Kern dissenting against Humani Vitae, they were allowed to conduct themselves in an unimpeded fashion, and that contributed mightily. That, with the lack of discipline from Rome and bishops, led to mightily to the corruption of Catholic institutions doctrinally and mission-wise.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, we can't read minds and know the intentions necessarily behind the actions of like Pope John the 23rd and other church leaders to kind of let neo-modernists thrive again. But it does seem to be the error of the idea that if we just all dialogue, if we all just have a conversation, then somehow the truth is going to show up and we're all going to accept it. And that's never been the way the church has operated. It's always been the truth is proclaimed. It's not just a matter of dialogue. And does that seem to you like legitimate? Like that was kind of their thinking. Like if we just all dialogue, eventually we'll all agree. Curran and Kung and Ratzinger and Wojtyła and everybody's just going to come together and say, okay, now we all agree.
Yes, it was. That was certainly an attitude. John the 23rd, in some of his remarks leading up to the opening of the Second Vatican Council, publicly stated that this council, the idea was we want to engage. So initially, Eric, the idea was not to engage people in the church who disagreed, like Hans Küng, because they weren't quite so bold yet. But the idea was to engage people outside the church, and if like atheists or non-Christians, non-Catholics, and if you just present the truth will prevail. Yes, that was an attitude. And here's something very critical. John the 23rd said that this council will present the perennial truths of the Catholic faith, but in a way that modern man can understand and that would be persuasive to modern people. And he said, no new anathemas. So we're not going to have any condemnations, excommunications, or heresies identified by Vatican II. And that's why people end up saying, oh yeah, it's a pastoral council. It's not a dogmatic council. There's a lot of doctrine in the council, but there are no new dogmas and there are no anathemas, that is condemnations of heresy and subsequent excommunications. What happens is bishops and subsequent popes seem to me took that note. In fact, people would say this explicitly. They'd take that directive from John the 23rd as a pastoral directive for decades to come. So no new anathemas meant what? Then it leads into the situation you describe, which is, okay, we're not going to condemn Kung or excommunicate him, but we'll enter into a dialogue with him, I suppose. I mean, John Paul II and Benedict XVI did take some disciplinary action against some of these folks, but it was mostly just silencing them. It was, you know, nothing close to excommunication. So when those of us who were in grad school in theology in the 1990s, at non-Newman guide institutions would hear as a mantra, you know, Father Charles Kern, Father Catholics in good standing, they're priests in good standing. And yes, they were priests in good standing. Now they weren't good theologians, but they were priests in good standing.
We'll be back after a quick break. Playlist shuffled? Check. Drinks on ice? Check. Z-Biotics? Make the most of your time with friends by starting your evening with Z-Biotics, the only pre-alcohol probiotic designed to make those rough mornings after drinking alcohol a thing of the past. Z-Biotics is key for those who live for the moment. Visit ZBiotics.com to learn more.
Yeah, so what would you say then is the big difference between how theology is taught today in your typical Catholic university, not a Newman guy school, and how it might have been taught maybe 120 years ago?
Well, 120 years ago, theology generally was principally the provenance of kind of the domain of priestly formation, so in the seminaries. Now, they would have theology courses at Catholic institutions for lay students, and it was fairly robust. I mean, by the middle of the 20th century, you know, most Catholic universities in the United States required 4 theology courses, 1 each year, freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior in college. Ralph McInerney, the late Ralph McInerney, who was one of the founders of Crisis Magazine, by the way, professor of philosophy at Notre Dame, has written quite a bit about this situation and how in the 60s, Catholic universities turned to a distributive core and they whittled down the theology requirements. But as far as theology for priestly formation in the early 20th century, it was very robust. And the methods utilized were theological manual and criticism, theologie, the new theologians like Henri de Lubac and others. And it's the manualists, neo-Thomist, manualist theology is much maligned. But that was the means by which many priests were formed, and it's a very helpful tool. Also, theologians had to take this oath against modernism, a very solemn oath, repudiating the errors of modernism, which included, among other things, denying the literal bodily resurrection of Christ, but saying his resurrection was in the minds and hearts of the people who loved him. He lived on after his death. So you had to take this oath against modernism, and the church was very, very strict with disciplining dissident theologians. Now, of course, there was a lot of collateral damage. A lot of some innocent people were accused and removed from positions. And so, yeah, there's collateral damage, but abuse does not or ought not take away use. But that's what happened because there were some mistakes. It seems to me that the church ends up not using the disciplinary means at her disposal after a while. But yes, in the early 20th century, theology was robust, not without its problems for sure, but it was very strictly regulated by the church. And so theologians, in a sense, were, and they were all clerics for the most part, with few exceptions, were seen as extensions of, in a sense, or at least cooperators with the church's magisterium.
Right, right. And I think that's probably that's the biggest difference with ways today that most Catholic theologians, they don't really connect themselves in any real way to the church's magisterium. It's just, you know, because you have now like feminist theology and all that stuff that has no connection to what the church really teaches. It's more speculative and with the world, so to speak. So how would you then, I mean, let's get back to basics here for a minute. How would you define theology? I mean, just theology itself.
Well, traditionally, and even in the current milieu, the church herself recently has affirmed that theology is a science. But by this, we don't mean science in the contemporary natural science or soft science sense, but in a classical sense, it's a science. A science in the classical sense is a habit of mind whereby conclusions about your topic, there are different sciences, conclusions about your topic are known with certitude by means of demonstration. And the mechanism of demonstration is called the syllogism. And that's not an artificial invention, but that's the natural organic movement of the mind from truths that are known to a truth that was formerly unknown. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. And then it was theology regarded the content, so it's a science that yields certitude, and the content are the mysteries of faith. So supernatural faith is required for theology, and means that and faith comes through the instruments the Lord has chosen to be his authentic public official witnesses. That would be the apostles and their successors, the bishops and the Pope. So faith comes from God through the church. It's a gift. And so adherence to the Catholic Church and the true, infallibly taught dogmas, which are the revealed mysteries of faith that Christ gave us, that's an essential sine qua non for doing the science of theology. And that's the basis for certitude, by the way, as well, is that we have faith in God, who is the truth, who can neither deceive nor be deceived. So that's what theology is. That's what it still is. But what's happened, I think you mentioned this a few minutes ago, is that theology has become kind of secularized. With the Land O'Lakes Declaration of Independence from the Magisterium, they asserted, well, you know, an outside body like bishops shouldn't have no business coming in and regulating experts, theologians who really know their stuff better than the bishops do. And then theology becomes detached from the church's oversight. And it's a very quick step, hop, skip, and a jump to theology becomes unmoored from faith itself. And so you find this really awkward, oxymoronic situation where you have, or ironic situation where you have theologians who, do they even believe the Catholic right. faith? Some of them seem not to.
Yeah, it seems like theology is almost just opinion. That, okay, I have my opinion of what the Bible says, what the church should teach, and you have your opinion. And so what matters is just simply, okay, whoever argues it best, I guess their theology wins. Instead of, whereas what you're saying, it sounds like theology is actually looking at something objective, something that is that we are to find, so to speak, that exists objectively outside of ourselves. Would that be a good way to put it?
Beautiful. I mean, theology always has been understood properly as the mind, through a supernatural grace of faith, coming to an objective external reality that is outside of your own invention, of the triune God, these supernatural mysteries of the triune God who loves us so much. The Son, God the Son, becomes a man, dies on the cross, establishes the church, establishes the magisterium. These are publicly revealed truths. The faith is very reasonable too. It's not proven by reason alone, but reason completely supports it. Yes, that, as opposed to the view of, like you said, the theology is an opinion, or really part of the issue of modernism is it's a Copernican revolution. It shifts this epicenter of theology from the objective truth of the triune God himself into the subject, into the person. It's not God necessarily. It's my private experience, my religious sense, my interreligious sense, and of something infinite, the divine, the infinite, the ineffable. And therefore dogma can never really capture that. And dogma is endlessly refinable, reversible, changeable in these folks' views. Yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah, I think that I think that's an important point there, that the object has changed from the triune God to basically us. We're the center of existence, which frankly that's what's happened, and that's the Western world since, you know, 1960s and before, even, you know, that we're the center of the world. And so everything is very much subjective. Now, I want to talk about a book that recently was translated into the English for the first time. You already mentioned the author, Father Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, and it's a two-volume work called On Divine Revelation. It just came out from Emmaus Academic. I have both of them here. You can see they're very hefty books. I will admit I have not read them all. So anybody thinks you have your copy too. Very good. So first, before we get in, we're bringing this book because it very much brings out what we're talking about here. First, tell me, who actually is Father Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange?
He was a French Dominican priest, theologian, wonderful, wonderful man. He wrote philosophical works. He wrote theological works. He was appointed professor of ascetical and mystical theology at the Angelicum, which is the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome, which had been run traditionally by the Dominicans and still is. He formed and directed the theses and dissertations of many very important theologians, including Karol Wojtyła, the future John Paul II. He made so many contributions, Eric, it's hard to summarize it, but I will. One of the biggest contributions he made is in spiritual theology. In his two-volume work, The Three Ages of the Interior Life, one of the central theses of that work is that the mystical union with God and perfection, spiritual perfection of charity and mystical union with God, is the ordinary course of the Christian life. It's not just for an extraordinary few, but it's for every Christian is called to that. And as a result, that insight, and he argued very, very thoroughly and exhaustively and to establish that truth or to reaffirm it, that was taken up by the Second Vatican Council in a chapter in the Dogmatic Constitution on the Church entitled The Universal Call to Holiness. So he was very important, and he wrote a number of works. And the one you're looking at now, this one, is you can call it a theology manual. I was talking a little bit about manuals, but it also is a standalone primary source work of theology itself. It's just tremendous, a tremendous work, a very important work.
So why exactly did he write this?
He was engaging current problems, and we're talking about early 20th century. There's a letter in the beginning of this, and it's not just the English translation, but the original French, or no, actually, I think he wrote it in Latin originally, by Pope Benedict XV, who that's early 20th century, who endorsed it. He was dealing with, so first of all, it's a work of Catholic apologetics. You hear apologetics and you might think of popular apologists who are great, okay, like from Catholic Answers or whatever, but this is actually apologetics in a classical theological professional key. So it's not exactly easily accessible to the educated non-expert, okay? But it's a real substantive work of theology. So why he wrote it was he was engaging current, part of what theologians do is we have to help bishops, we have to help the church combat errors in the current milieu, whether the errors are from within the church or in society, that threaten the truth of the faith and therefore threaten the salvation of souls and the glory that we owe to God. So a couple of the issues on the table that he's dealing with at the time were similar issues that Vatican I was dealing with, namely rationalism. That's the idea that human reason, natural reason alone, is the sole criterion of truth, that there can be no supernatural interruption into the natural order, that that's not possible. There's no divine revelations possible. So it's on divine revelation. No divine revelations possible. So that's a view of hardcore rationalists, especially people like David Hume, the great English philosopher and historiographer. There's also other errors like pantheism, believe it or not. Pantheism, the idea that the finite world is the infinite God, which in this text, in this book, Guy Lagrange says that's absolutely absurd. You can't even cognize that. It doesn't even make sense to say the finite's the infinite. But in any event, pantheism was actually fairly significant as well. Some pantheists we know about, the American naturalists like Thoreau, or Wordsworth, okay? But they're also hardcore philosophical pantheists as well. So he's defending the rationale, he's defending the reasonability of the Catholic faith, in particular, that it's reasonable that God can reveal and that revelation's not only possible, but needed, it's necessary. And that's the first book here. And in the second book, he's arguing that revelation, which we've established as possible and fitting and even necessary for humans, right, actually occurred through Jesus Christ and the Catholic Church. He established is the venue, is the conduit, is the guardian and protector and promoter and promulgator of that divine revelation. That's it in a nutshell. That's what the two books are about.
It almost seems also like that. I mean, obviously, he wrote a long time ago, but when was it first? When did he first publish? When was it first published, actually? Was it the 20s?
Well, I don't know the exact date, but it was in the teens, like 19. Well, maybe. I think it was. If Benedict the 15th is endorsing it. It's funny, the title page. Yeah, the fifth edition was published in Rome in French in 1950, okay? But that's the fifth edition. First edition was much earlier. I think it was in the teens, maybe 1917, maybe 19, right around 1920.
Okay. So what's interesting the title of the book itself seems to be on the Divine Revelation. Seems in a way to expose today's errors in theology departments because they don't seem to be addressing divine revelation, something given to them, but instead they're addressing something they're inventing, and so to speak. So what is that relationship between divine revelation and theology?
Well, that's wonderful, Eric. Let's start with what's going on in some kind of corrupted milieu in theology today. It really is, again, it's neo-modernism all over again, so to speak. And divine revelation doesn't occur publicly by a divinely appointed person holding an office, like Jesus Christ. He's not only divinely appointed, he is divine. He holds an office, priest, prophet, and king. He's anointed in his humanity, and he preaches publicly, and he establishes a public body. From among his disciples, he chooses 12, makes them apostles, gives them public authority to make binding and loosing, his terms, binding and loosing decisions. So in the true sense, the epicenter of revelation occurs publicly. We talk about public revelation versus private revelation. Public revelation ceases with the death of the last apostle, that is St. John. Whereas in the current milieu, revelation, this is riffing on classical modernism, revelation is an interior experience. It's a private experience. It's a religious sense, an interreligious sense. Like we say, the epicenter is shifted within the subject. And therefore, theology then becomes more of a creative endeavor. Systematic theology is understood incorrectly as this creative endeavor where we kind of create a system rather than a discovery of the orderly system of divinely revealed mysteries of faith that Jesus and his apostles and their successors have and continue to reveal to us. This is very, very big difference. And that's why, in part, these texts are extremely important today, because he helps to argue very soundly and thoroughly, not only for the reasonability of the Catholic faith, of the fact that God can reveal, for the divinity of Christ, for his establishing of the church, for the necessity of people to enter the church, not just as individuals, but even as society. But he also argues very well and correctly for the public official nature of revelation as something objective, and that theology, properly understood, as you keep going back to, thank you, Eric, is really a seeking of understanding of this publicly revealed body of most precious supernatural truths. It's faith seeking understanding, not cleverness seeking to create a structure.
Right. And so, like you mentioned before, how the theology manuals back in the day, they're often mocked today. They're often ridiculed, considered not really something that we should do anymore. And this is, I think it would fall under the category, at least generally, of a theology manual from that era. So what is your defense of theology manuals in general and this on divine revelation in particular?
Good. So theology, a manual, think of the Latin manus, hand. In Greek, it's enchiridion. It's a handbook. That is a book you can hold in your hand and have a concise distillation of everything you want to talk about all in that one tome, as opposed to shelves and shelves full of what? Well, look, here are the sources that need to be examined to do professional theology responsibly in an orthodox key, and that would be sacred scripture, all of the monuments of tradition. The monuments of tradition, the repositories of tradition, are all the writings of the fathers of the church, all the magisterial statements of councils, local and universal councils, all the official statements of popes. That fills shelf after shelf after shelf, and you can't carry all that around in your hand. So a manual, a handbook, takes a specific topic, like in this case, divine revelation, which again would fill shelves and shelves for the primary sources, and the author distills them down into fundamental, clearly, if it's done well, accurate and extremely helpful summaries. And the best manuals, and many of them, most of them are very, very good in my opinion, theology and philosophy manuals in the Catholic Church in the 20th century, even in the 19th century, they articulate, I mean, sometimes, and you'll see this in this text, sometimes half of the page is full of, is just a footnote, like half the page is just a big old footnote. And in the footnote, you find the sources, or sometimes in the text itself. Where do you find this doctrine of, let's say, the Trinity or whatever you're talking about in Scripture, Old Testament, New Testament? Where do you see it in the writings of the fathers of the church? Where do you see it among the writings of heretics? And they name the sources so that the person reading it can then go to the shelves and pull out those sources. Where have church councils discussed it? Where have popes discussed it? And all those sources are articulated and listed. And then in addition, what have heretics said about it in their sources? What about unanswered questions on that topic? Unanswered meaning by there's no definitive teaching on the church yet about some topics. So what is the current state of debate about, let's say, predestination or some other doctrine? And these handbooks or manuals will show you, here's the Scotus position, the Thomist position, the Bellarmine, the Jesuit position, etc. And again, they will cite these sources. So manuals are meant to be kind of points of entry. Now, they kind of serve two functions, but first we should mention the criticism of them. The criticism was this. These manuals were given to priests in formation. So instead of, now this is a caricature, it's not fair, but here's the criticism. Instead of reading scripture, instead of reading the fathers of the church, instead of reading the church councils, they just read the manual, then get ordained, and that's all they know. Did that happen? Sure. Is that working as intended? No, not exactly. But anyway, what happened as a result, the pendulum swings way the other direction, and you have the rise of what's called nouvelle théologie, these new theologians or the new theology, where they're doing resource mont, that means going back to the sources. So it's de Lubach, von Balthasar, others. They're going back to scripture, back to the fathers of the church. Jean Danielou is another one. Even to some degree, Ratzinger was part of this. And so instead of the manuals, you get rid of those manuals. They're distracting. They're unhelpful. They're curmudgeonly. I think it was de Lubach who called Gergou Lagrange the sacred monster of Thomism. He was a Thomist of the strict observance. They'd constantly lampoon the guy. unfairly. And so they kind of eliminate. So the sources they go back to are scripture and the fathers, sometimes the medievals, sometimes Aquinas and Bonaventure, but certainly they don't look at the moderns. Resource Mont, they don't go back to Bellarmine, Suarez, the anti, the kind of the Catholic counter-reformers, not, and especially not these 20th century manuals. I mean, they were the enemy. Neo-Thomists were the enemy. And, they were curmudgeonly and crusty and old, and get rid of that. Let's revitalize theology. Well, what ends up happening is you throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's even worse than that, so I think. The idea is manuals are repositories of the whole tradition. And you throw them out, you're going to end up with some problems. Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things currently, he wrote an excellent article a couple decades ago entitled Theology After the Revolution, where he says, look, these guys, these Nouvelle Théologie guys, in the name of doing exploratory theology, they end up kind of throwing out Neo-Thomism and throwing out really solid Orthodox theology that was occurring in the 20th century. And perhaps unintentionally, their students are unmoored and they just go off in directions that De Lubac and others themselves were horrified with. That's not what we don't want them to get detached from the tradition, but they themselves detach from the tradition by kind of throwing out whole portions of it. So manuals have at least two very helpful foci, and one is to help priests in formation. So, and they don't, yes, that's right. They don't always read all the fathers of the church, et cetera, but in teaching as a priest and homilies, et cetera, you keep your manual from seminary. And then you see where you can look in St. Augustine, where you can see this in Aquinas, where you can see this in the Council of Trent. And if they have a library, they back there before the internet, they could go to the library and dig this up for teaching purposes or homily purposes. That's for priests. For professional theologians, they're also very helpful so that you don't have to go dig through and search all these different collections. Where did this pope or that pope, or this council, that council, or this heretic talk about this topic? Manuals will be a quick point of entry. That's the beginning, not the end of theology. It brings you into the discussion, and then you do more research. So manuals are extremely important, and it's a tragedy that they were impugned, lampooned, and ejected from. So Emmaus Academic Press is doing a great service of reviving a bunch of manual publications. They're very helpful, very relevant, I think, especially this one.
Yeah, I would think I'd much rather have a priest who was trained simply on manuals, these manuals, than what a lot of them get today. I mean, let's be honest. It's like you said, it's unmoored. So if they're just got the manuals alone, even that's got to be an improvement. I know what you're saying. It is obviously a starting point. But even if it was the ending point, it's better in some ways than what we have now. Okay, so no doubt. With On Divine Revelation. So Emmaus Academic, this is the first time this has ever been translated into English, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so how could this, I mean, I don't know, we can't speak for Emmaus Academic, why they published it, but how would you say this would be used today? Obviously, a typical Catholic's not going to use this to homeschool their elementary school kid. But I would think that this could be very useful for priests, obviously, for seminaries, for school, for university theology departments. Is there other ways that just other than that a book like this book can be used?
Sure. Like you said, yes, priests, seminaries, theologians, of course. You can use it in the collegiate level. You could use it even as an upperclassman undergraduate class level. It requires a moderate amount of kind of preparation in grasping some fundamental theological and philosophical terms or realities, such as the syllogism, certain logical principles, certain metaphysical principles. It presupposes the reader has a basic grasp of a lot of that. Now, I'll tell you what, I maybe was a little too harsh earlier when I said it's not, even the well-educated Catholic would have difficulty with it. Look, the very motivated, educated, non-expert Catholic, non-theologian Catholic, who's like an autodidact, especially with the internet, you can find out the meaning of these terms very, very, a lot of scholastic terms very easily, act and potency and things like that. So actually it would, you could say with some difficulty, but with great fruit, it can be accessible to even the educated non-expert. But there's another category of folks too. It would be very helpful for bishops. It'd be very helpful for members of the magisterium and popes, to be honest. I mean, look, grace doesn't obviate nature. So they have grace of office, sure. And there's grace when they're composing magisterial documents. But manuals like this are very helpful if you're going to be kind of reflecting on how ought I compose this or that magisterial document. Gregory Lagrange, by the way, was consulted by Pius XII in at least two magisterial document preparations. One was the document where Pius XII dogmatically defined the Assumption of Mary, and the other was Pius XII's criticism of neo-modernism and the Nouvelle Théologie movement in his encyclical Humani Generis. People even say Garrigou Lagrange was the ghostwriter of that 1950 encyclical. But in any event, members of the magisterium need to have resources like this available, and they need to look at them because, like I said, grace doesn't eliminate the need for natural study. Copious difficult work. So you make sure that what you're passing on is everything and only those things that Jesus revealed and that were passed on by the apostles and their successors.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you plan on using this text in any of the classes that you're going to be teaching in the next year or two?
Yes, not only do I, but I just talked with a colleague from University of Dallas last night, and he's like, Mike, he's on like page 500 something of this first volume. He's like, I'm going to retool this whole class. And we were geeking out together. I'm going to retool at least three or four of my classes. So let me just give you a little background here. 25 years ago or so, I had, and I still have it on my shelf, I got a copy of De Revelatione, which is what this is in Latin, the original Latin of Garrigou's text here. And I said, this is tremendous. You know, there's got to be an English translation of this, because to be honest, most theologians are not fluent in Latin. We can read it with a dictionary and do fine with it. It takes a little longer than reading English, so it'd be easier if it's in English. So I started an English translation, but I realized, my goodness, this is over 1,000 pages, and I'll just be translating? I actually have to do my work. So I couldn't do it. So this has been a long time coming for a lot of us. Used to be the case that theologians were required to not only master Latin, but the oral examinations to get your licentiate in theology or your doctorate in theology and ecclesial programs were in Latin. Sometimes very often the lectures were in Latin. My late father had attained a licentiate in philosophy from Fordham University in New York in the 1960s, early 60s. And his final oral examination for his licentiate was in Latin. My dad spoke Latin. There's very few of us who do that any longer. So the English translation is extremely helpful. And yes, a bunch of us are going to be retooling a number of classes to use these texts.
Right. Well, let's bring it back. Let's try to wrap it up here. And let's bring it back to the idea of Catholic theology departments. Where would you say obviously the Newman guide is a good indicator, but let's just give your opinion. What do you think are some of the best theology departments in the United States today?
That's tricky. There's two ways I could answer it, and I will. One is just the department as a whole in a given university, and the other would be targeted individuals at universities, okay? So as a whole, generally, whole departments of theology are generally reliable if you find them on the Newman guide, but make sure you pay attention to that Newman list, because sometimes universities come on the list or go off the list, and faculty profiles can change. But not to be too self-aggrandizing, but Franciscan's fantastic faculty. We just have tremendous scholars. We're known for popular theology, but there's a lot of fantastic scholarship and contributions to scholarship. We have members of our department on ecumenical dialogues, but who are approaching it knowing the Catholic faith is the true faith. Okay, it's not mealy-mouthed. So it's good. It's good here. You have some fantastic theologians at Kansas Benedictine, some fantastic theologians. One of them is a good friend of mine at University of Dallas. Providence College has some fantastic Thomists. I don't know if I'm allowed to name names, but Bob Berry is fantastic, and Paul Gondreau. There are wonderful Thomists all over the place. Then there's some targeted places. For example, University of St. Thomas in Minnesota generally has had a lot of trouble with its Catholic identity. It's not on the Newman list, but there are tremendous Orthodox theologians teaching there. The great John Boyle, the great Thomist John Boyle, teaches in the Catholic Studies program, not even in theology, but he's a theologian. Dr. Christian Washburn teaches in St. Paul's Major Seminary, which is part of the University of St. Thomas. So there are great theologians all over the place. But really, I think the Newman guide is very helpful, because you don't want to go for those targeted theologians at places that otherwise are kind of corrupt, because you want your son or daughter to be exposed to an integrated Catholic life. And that's why the Newman guide schools are so helpful. But the reason I mentioned targeted individual theologians, and there are very many, I didn't mention, there are tons, would be very helpful for people who are looking at for graduate work, okay, in theology. And then what you do, you're looking for someone who could direct a thesis or a doctoral dissertation, and you just go to websites. Go to Fordham's website, Notre Dame. Notre Dame has, believe it or not, some fantastic Orthodox theologians teaching there. So you go to their websites, go to the faculty page in theology, and then look at the CV, the curriculum vitae, like the resume of these different folks, and you'll see pretty quickly, you'll get it. You should get a sense if they're solid or Orthodox or not.
Right. Okay, good. I mean, I'm glad to hear there seems to be many more. When I was first started going to the master's program in theology in the mid-90s, it was 1994, I went to Franciscan, but I was looking also at other grad schools, looking at doctoral programs. And to be honest, it seemed like a pretty desolate landscape at that time. And I feel like things have improved greatly in the 25, 30 years since then. Would that be true?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I'm with you. I was around the same time looking for graduate work just a couple years later, graduate programs in 96. And it was bleak. You remember back then, what was her name? Mary Daly? Was she at Boston College? She was into Wicca. Yeah. She was a nun who was promoting Wicca, witchcraft, you know, like, what the heck is this stuff? No, it was bad. Charles Curran had just left Catholic University. I mean, it was pretty, there was dissent, was pretty widespread. And yes, no, it's different now. In fact, it's more polarized. So you have Catholic University getting a lot more Orthodox. For a while there, Notre Dame was getting a lot more Orthodox, but then other places were really dropping off, like Villanova. You know, may know Massimo Fagioli. Yeah. You know that name?
Yes,
anyway, so they kind of dropped off, But by the way, if I may just say one thing, because I don't want to miss saying this. Among many topics that he treats, just an example of how relevant this is, he talks about the motives of credibility, the motives for believing that Jesus is revealing God's word and others are miracles and prophecy. It's not just David Hume in the 18th century, the 1700s, who denied very hardcore denied that miracles were even possible. And therefore, people after him said, therefore, the Gospels can't be historical, right? People to this day, we're still fighting this fight. Among Catholic theologians, many of us are arguing, no, the Gospels are historical. People have heard of the Jesus movement, and they try to say large portions, most of the Gospels are just not historical. They're myth. We have to demythologize, purify the Gospel message from these miracles. Jesus didn't multiply loaves. He just encouraged people to share, blah, blah, blah. You know all that. Well, listen, that's one of the big topics that he completely and thoroughly refutes, the claim that miracles are not possible. Prophecy is not possible. The Gospels are not historical. All those are treated masterfully, copiously, thoroughly, and really definitively. You end up with certitude about those. And that's so necessary these days. Because look, if the Gospels aren't historical, what are we even doing as Catholics? Really, it is. It's navel-gazing. And by the way, that redounds and echoes into the liturgy, too. That's a whole other topic, I know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I do think it's a two-volume work on divine revelation, The Teaching of the Catholic Faith by Father Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange. I do think it really does combat a lot of our modern problems, even though it was written 100 years ago, about 100 years ago. It really does address those. And the great thing about this being released into English, and it's you can buy it at the St. Paul Center. I'll put a link in the show notes. But the St. Paul Center, which is kind of the umbrella organization for Emmaus Academic, they're selling it for $99 right now on sale. And $99, I know, sounds a lot, like a lot, and it is a lot. I don't want to act like it's not. But this is too, for those who are just listening won't see this, but this is two hardback, very well, good quality, thick books. I mean, there's just so much in here. That's a very good deal. You typically, I don't know, people who actually buy graduate books for graduate school, stuff like that. My wife's taking a program in nutrition graduate school, and like she gets a textbook and it's like at least $200, if not $300, $400. So this is, you know, for $99 for both these, I'm not trying to be the salesman here, but I do know $99 might sound like a lot, but for a book like this, that's actually pretty dirt cheap. So I would just encourage people who are, particularly those who are interested, all priests, any priest, every single one of you, I'd encourage, buy one for your priest if you think he'd be open to reading it. Obviously, as you said, bishops, I don't know if they'd have time to read it, but if you think there's a priest who might become a bishop someday, get him the book. So I just think it could be useful. Obviously, and then, you know, if you're looking at schools for theology departments, see if they're in the next couple of years, see if they're going to be using a book like this. So I really think I encourage people to look into it. So any last thoughts, Mike, on this topic that we've been talking about?
I do have one. You wrote a fantastic book on indifferentism. Okay.
Oh, thank you.
So
that's right up here. Right up
I would. Here. I would. No, really, it's wonderful. I love it. And just for you, Eric, and others who are interested, since you haven't read it all, and it's just a long read, right? You could go to the end of the second volume, and in it, I think you'd really like this a lot. He has a whole refutation of indifferentism, and on the duty, once it's clear that Christ has revealed the truth of the faith and authorized the church officially to be its guardian and promoter, there's a duty of individuals, the civil state, and society. Those three. He has three sections. Arguments for the duties for individuals, civil state, and society to be Catholic. It's a moral necessity once you understand certain things. So there's a condition, but it's conditional. Call it conditional moral necessity. But I think you like that section.
Oh, definitely. I'm going to skip to the end now. I'm going to go to that part.
Yeah, right to the end.
That's great. Well, I appreciate you coming on today, Mike, and this has been great. So again, encourage people to look into on Divine Revelation. I'll put a link to it. Also, I'll put a link into the Newman Guide for those who are looking into different schools, because I agree that it's a great resource. But thanks so much for being on the program today.
Thanks for all your great work, Eric. God bless you.
Okay, God bless you. And everybody else, until next time, God love you.